all approved when you heard rain. Won't you stop and listen to the children sing? Or won't you sing it, children? Won't you come on and sing it, children?
Well, that, of course, was Leon Russell and the Shelter People singing Stranger in a Strange Land from 1971. I thought it might, it was a sort of an appropriate soliloquy for these days and times. Good afternoon, KSQD listeners in Santa Cruz, Monterey, and online, and in the KSQD studio. It's every other Sunday again. It's day 90 of the great lockdown, whose end of the tunnel we can maybe see the light of now. Welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. And I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Joe Chamberlain. You there, Joe?
Yes, I am.
Okay, Joe is executive director of the Coastside Land Trust in Half Moon Bay. She's a graduate of College 8 at UC Santa Cruz, or what used to be College 8, and she was a provost assistant there for several years over the past decade. She served on several nonprofit boards, including the San Francisco Zoological Society and Friends of Westwind, and has experience in corporate management, environmental education, and the nonprofit sector. The Coastside Land Trust is dedicated to the preservation, protection, and enhancement of the open space environment, including the natural, scenic, recreational, cultural, historical, and agricultural resources of Half Moon Bay up the coast and the San Mateo County coast for present and future generations. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Ronnie.
Well, let's begin, okay? Why don't you start by telling us what a land trust is and, you know, what it can do and how it operates?
Well, in the context of the Coastside Land Trust, we are a 501c3, which means that we are a nonprofit formed for the public's benefit. We do not pay taxes. However, we have to pay property taxes on the lands that we acquire. And our mission is to protect the west side of one properties for the public's benefit, and that's either to use for recreation, scenic, agriculture. And so when we drive along Highway 1, rather than looking at buildings, you'll be looking at ag fields or open space, trees, grasslands, and have access to the coast, of course. So that's our goal. We acquire properties between Montera Mountain and the San Mateo border with Santa Cruz County and up to the ridgeline here, over to the ridgeline between us and the Bay Area. So it's quite a large area that we cover.
And how do you operate? What sorts of things do you do?
Well, we are funded by private donations and public grants, and we receive grants to acquire land and to create recreational opportunities, such as the construction of the California Coastal Trail through the community of Half Moon Bay, and also to acquire lands that have significant habitat significance. So, for example, wetlands and riparian corridors, and land that is unfortunately destined for construction, if not saved from construction and kept in agricultural lands.
How did you end up at the Coastside Land Trust?
I was invited some years ago, 2005, I believe it was, to join their board of directors, which I did, and I served as their president for a while, and then they asked if I would consider taking on the position of executive director, which I was happy to do, and I've been very happy to serve in that position until now, and I'm continuing to serve.
How did your background or your experience prepare you for something like this?
Well, I believe an executive director of a nonprofit needs to, number one, have knowledge of the subject matter that the nonprofit is providing. And, of course, my education at Rachel Carson College at UC Santa Cruz has turned out to be incredibly invaluable in my understanding of the ecological and habitat and community needs that must be met to make sure that these beautiful lands are protected for the public's benefit.
So I was looking.
I also was have a good business head and helped form other additional nonprofits. So I understood the requirements of you must be qualified under IRS. You must file, and we have to file financial statements, even though we don't pay income taxes. We must declare all of our funds, and we must acknowledge all of the gifts from the people who donate to us. Because currently and still under IRS law, donations to a nonprofit are deductible to a certain extent.
Yeah. So, how do you acquire the lands? I mean, what's what's the mechanism?
Yeah. In my particular case, with the Coastside Land Trust, we request people to donate properties. There are many very small properties within the boundaries of the Midcoast, which is Monterra, El Granada, and Moss Beach, and Half Moon Bay, that was subdivided into tiny little parcels by the historic Ocean Shore Railroad. And some of the properties are 25 by 100 feet, and some even smaller, and some have several owners. And they are in incredibly sensitive habitat, agriculture, riparian corridors, scenic corridors, and recreational access corridors. And since they haven't been able to develop for decades, back from, I believe, the railroad stopped doing business in 1906, 1910 or 12. And since then, people have continued to pay property taxes and had hopes to construct. They were selling these lots for $20, and many people have kept them in their families for decades. And they decide that it's not likely they would ever be able to develop them, and they're happy to place them in a nonprofit, which promises to keep them in open space for the public's benefit in perpetuity. And, of course, they can continue to visit their properties as well. And we're happy to walk with them on the property and explain how it fits into our overall picture.
So, I mean, that's going back to what you were saying about the coast, the railroad. What was it called?
It was called the Ocean Shore Railroad.
Ocean Shore Railroad. Mm-hmm. Why were they dividing up the properties?
Well, I believe that, now this was at the turn of the century, and railroads were able to acquire lands for building if they built the railroad. I'm sure you're familiar with the railroad land grab throughout the West. And for every mile of track that was laid, they would get a mile of land or a hectare of land on each side.
Right.
And it's similar to if you look at the Forest Service maps in Northern California, and you have that checkerboard pattern. And so along here, from what I can see, they acquired all of the lands. And what they had, what their marketing and sales plan was, to build the railroad, and then people in San Francisco would purchase a lot down here for the summer. And then they would get on the train and come down and spend the summers here on the beautiful coast, which it certainly is beautiful, but it's
sounds
not
familiar.
That warm.
Yeah.
I think that I think disappointed a lot of people, and there were great plans to build piers and swimming platforms and things. I just think I sort of suspect, looking at it now, that maybe it wasn't really that conducive to what they had, how it had been marketed. And then, so as a result, the properties, many of the properties were not developed for a century or so. And now, of course, the pressure for development is the same here as you experience in Santa Cruz County.
Yeah, I saw that you got some, that some of the parcels haven't had property taxes paid on them for a long time, and they go into foreclosure, or no? What does the county do? What's that called?
So
forfeiture.
With property taxes, the county can decide when they've gone unpaid for a certain period of time and acquired a certain dollar amount in back taxes.
Yeah.
They call them tax default parcels.
Yeah.
And they spend a lot of time, and with many of them in this area, as you can imagine, nobody, they can't find the owners because someone bought it in 1900 and, you know, the property taxes were so low that, or there were enough changes of ownership in the land, and it was just lost. It just fell through the cracks with some families. As you can understand, that's possible. And because it was not, did not have a significant dollar amount. And so then the state declares them in default after doing extensive research, and then they apply to the state of California to take ownership of the properties, and the state of California authorizes that, then they can put them up for sale. Fortunately, in our county, and I don't know if this is true in all counties, but in San Mateo County, the tax collector gives municipalities and nonprofit land trusts, or I think even just all nonprofits, the opportunity to purchase them for the back taxes and some minor fees prior to placing them up for public auction. So we have been very fortunate that our supporters have been incredibly generous with us financially and provided the funding we've needed to acquire many parcels through the tax default system.
Well, I know I'm getting into the weeds here, but I'm curious, what's the value of a 25 by 100 foot parcel in this day and age? I mean, what are the taxes on something like that? Do you know?
I don't know. Tax assessors, when a property changes hands, as you know, under Prop 13, it can be reassessed.
Right.
So the property taxes are all over the map because some of these have changed hands, and as a result, some people are paying a significant amount of tax for a property that in likelihood is never going to be able to be developed. And so we are an opportunity for them to donate that property, and then they're able to deduct the value of that property according to the rules of the state and federal government and their with their approval of their CPA or tax preparer.
Okay. Well, Joe, we have to take a break for a couple of minutes, so... hello, you're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. That's right. They can help save lives by simply washing their hands. Just 20 seconds of thorough hand washing after they've coughed or sneezed or been outside can help fight against the dastardly spread of germs. Armed with only soap and water and hands, your superhero can protect you, your family, and everyone out there in America land. Amazing! Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
Well, you're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest this week is Joe Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Coastside Land Trust in Half Moon Bay. We've been talking about how the land trust acquires property, especially from people who have properties that have been in default for long periods of time because the owners have been lost or are not paying their taxes. Bad citizens. Joe, do you know a lot about land trusts in general in the state of California? Because I was looking this up the other day, you know, and I didn't find yours on the list of coastal land trusts. So I imagine there are probably more than just the sort of big ones.
Right. There are some land trusts that only own one property or one building. So they can be large, such as the Peninsula Open Space Trust, which I believe at this point covers five counties, or they can be small, such as our land trust that is just in coastal San Mateo County. Pacifica has a land trust as well, and we, of course, work closely with all of the land trusts and all of the districts, the regional, mid-peninsula regional open space district, and Peninsula Open Space Trust, so that no one is duplicating effort. So we work as a coalition, and each of us communicates with everyone what our goals are in the area, and how we're going to proceed. And that way, the public's funding, as well as the federal and state and local granting process, we're not duplicating any effort, and we're maximizing the use of the public's money in protecting these lands.
I noticed on the website somewhere that you described the CLT as an urban land trust, and that you said that's different from most land trusts. Is that the case?
I believe so, because, well, Pacifica would be an urban land trust as well, because we function primarily within the developed area of the San Mateo Coast. Uh-huh. So the Tri-County, the cities, Montera, El Granada, and Moss Beach, and Half Moon Bay, Pescadero, are the areas that we primarily function. The bigger acquisitions, such as 2,000-3,000 acres or larger, is better suited for a land trust with more sophistication than we have, like the Peninsula Open Space Trust or the district, the Mid-Peninsula Regional Open Space District.
So what kind of land use problems are faced by Half Moon Bay? I'm just thinking about, you know, housing is probably pretty expensive, and rents are high, so there must be a lot of development pressure on the community and on the coast.
Yes, there is significant building pressure on the coast side. There's no question about that. We do have limitations, and they are the three big ones that we normally come across: water, sewage, and transportation. Mm-hmm. For example, we only have Highway 1 that goes north and south, and then there are very few east-west roads. So there's 92. As Sharp Park in Pacifica, there's 84 in San Gregorio, and of course there's a route through Pescadero. But all of these north-south corridors are one or, you know, just two-lane highways, very crooked, narrow. And so when people come to visit us on the weekend, it is many hours of waiting to go east and west. And that's not something that can be solved. And then, of course, water, as you know, most of our water here, I don't know, I can't remember in Santa Cruz County where what the water source is, but here most of ours is Hetch Hetchy. We also have Stone Dam, which is at the head of Pilarcitos Creek. And that's a significant amount of water, but it goes into the Crystal Springs Reservoir, and then we are allocated our water accordingly. And our sewer plant is very small and is being asked to take on a larger capacity than it was constructed for.
So you get your water from San Francisco, basically, is that if it comes from Crystal Springs?
It does come from Crystal Springs, that is correct. We have the Coastside County Water District that manages that.
Okay. I lost my train of thought there. Do people ever complain that the land trust is taking, you know, valuable land out of development, that it's somehow an elitist project to keep people out of Half Moon Bay? You know, we have that here in Santa Cruz, that kind of argument. Do you hear that kind of thing?
Yes, we do hear that. And it's normally from people who want to develop. And the people who live here, however, want to keep their beautiful open spaces, because that's why they purchased property here and moved their families here, is that they wanted to live in a more rural and coastal community that's not so crowded. So we have we have, everyone has a right to their opinion and their position.
Go on.
No, that was me.
Oh, okay. Are there any big, you know, so are there any big development projects underway in the area? And I know there is one. I can't remember what it's called, but can you tell us about that?
Sure. There's a developer who wants to develop Surf Beach, which is two of our largest remaining agricultural terraces. It's west of one, and one is called Surf Beach, and one is called Dunes Beach. And the project is referred to as the Dunes Beach Development. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the properties, the Dune Beach property, only has about three owners, and they have fairly good-sized pieces of property. However, the Surf Beach tract, the Coastside Land Trust owns 17 of the lots in that area. And it's currently in agriculture. Hay and peas and strawberries are raised there every year. And mm-hmm. that Surf Beach tract, under the current developer plan, would have 147 RV trailers parked on it. And there would be a restaurant and a swimming pool and a center of some kind. And then the Dunes Beach tract would have a hotel that I think holds, the last I heard, 234 rooms. And it would have extensive grounds and cabins. And would basically, all the current plan is that all of the land would be covered.
Mm-hmm.
So we have offered to enter into negotiations to acquire with the developer to acquire these properties, but they have not been willing to discuss that with us.
But both of these developments are basically for visitors, huh? They're not housing.
Yes, and this is where it gets interesting, Ronnie, because the California Coastal Commission requires us to have visiting service amenities.
Yeah.
And they are able to have all the water and sewer that they want. Whereas if you and I were to try to build a home, it would be $100,000 to purchase a water permit.
Yeah.
But because the Coastal Commission has this authority, that means that there will be, how many is that, 400 new places that have water, and we don't have enough water now. And there will be how many cars, and we're already graded at an F for our traffic. And in an emergency, if it's foggy, there's only one way out. You know, either there's three ways, really, south, north, or east. And the helicopters can't always come in because of the fog. So it's an interesting question about, does our community want to let this development go forward, or would they prefer to support our position and keep these properties in agriculture?
Uh-huh. So, you know, you mentioned the Coastal Commission. What sort of role does the Coastal Commission play in all of this?
The Coastal Commission has authority all along our coast. The entire city of Half Moon Bay is under the Coastal Commission's jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that we have to have what's called a local coastal plan, which our city is in the process of updating, that talks about how we're going to allow our city to be developed and managed. And we have to, so that presents things like land use, zoning, habitat, basically everything you can think of. So, the Coastal Commission has to approve that plan, and then the city enforces it. And in many instances, even if the city is to approve something, it can be appealed to the Coastal Commission.
Yeah, I know that a Coastal Commission permit is like, well, it's probably more than gold at this point, isn't it? It's hard to get. I was thinking about the Cypress Point project, which is affordable housing. And I was wondering, since that's on the east side of Highway 1, is that of interest or concern to you?
We have no position on development on the east side of Highway 1.
Okay, so it's only the coastal property. Okay.
Yes.
When you're looking to acquire land, it probably helps to get to know people in the community, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And so, how do you do that?
Well,
these are pointers for people who want to start up nonprofits too, right? How do you schmooze people?
Well, I think that's a good point, Ronnie. And the first thing to know about having a nonprofit is that you serve your community. You're there for the public's benefit, mm-hmm. and you need to get to know everyone, and that means your neighbors and folks that work with the school districts, work with the city council and planning commission, and with all the other nonprofits who are working in your area, and mm-hmm. build a coalition of support for your mission, which you think you read earlier, Ronnie. Thank you for reading that earlier. So our mission is very much supported in our community. We do things like we used to hold in-person workshops and walks, and now with the shelter in place, we're doing a virtual bird workshop online, which is really fun, and we learn a great deal with these, and anyone who's interested, they're free. You can register on our website, and love to have folks join us to learn about the birds. So one of our goals is to provide education about what we're doing and what's important about the lands that we're caring for. So learning mm-hmm. about the birds and the frogs and the plants and the snakes and and everything is really important. And we also believe in the future of the stewardship of public lands. And so we have a program called the Junior Land Stewards Program.
Uh-huh.
And this is a cross-age teaching program within our public school, the Cabrillo Unified School District. And we have a manager, and she coordinates with the schools that we primarily work with the fourth grade and the high school students in the Environmental Studies AP program are the leaders of small groups of the fourth graders. And they go through a series of activities, both in the field and in the classroom, and it meets their science requirement, which is wonderful. And the young people get to go out and plant things and look at bugs and get dirty and grow their own plants. And our goal with that is to teach folks, starting at a young age, that public lands are the responsibility of all of us, that there isn't a mysterious somebody or something that cares for the public lands. They're the responsibility of each of us because they are our properties, they are our lands, and we are responsible for caring for them.
That raises a question in my mind, but we have to take a break before I ask you that question. So hi out there, you're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and online at ksqd.org. We're your ink spot on the radio dial, and over to Emily.
Got an old car taking up space in your garage or driveway? Why not put a squid behind the wheel? Donate your used car to KSQD through the Car Easy Donation Program. They even make the arrangements to have it towed. You get a tax deduction, and KSQD gets a monetary contribution. For more information, go to the donate page of our website, ksqd.org. Thanks.
Vroom, vroom. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Joe Chamberlain, Executive Director of the Coastside Land Trust in Half Moon Bay. So I mentioned a question had occurred to me, and this is a kind of a more general and philosophical one. Some people argue with respect to land trusts, I've seen this argument, that there is an issue here, right? These are public lands, and the government, in this case, you could say the California state government, is shirking its responsibility basically by encouraging what are in effect private, you know, organizations to acquire land. Do you transfer this land to the state? What do you think about that particular argument?
I think it's an excellent argument, and I agree completely that there is a problem with funding of the institutions that are that we have set up to take care of, to acquire and take care of our lands. And sometimes we don't, but many land trusts and districts transfer land from these are private. These are private nonprofits. Mine is private nonprofit. And we transfer lands to the state or the county or the city for their management. The one thing about property that's held in a land trust, unlike lands that are in the public management and ownership, is we can prevent anything happening to them. Whereas if the state owns 500 acres, it could at any point choose to sell that land into private ownership. We don't do that. So one of the things about placing your land in a land trust is that it will stay there permanently. It won't ever be subject to development. And the other difficulty, of course, with public lands, as I started saying, is that we don't fund them anymore. And as a result, they're being misused. The amount of garbage that is left on the beaches and the amount of damage that's done to the habitat near the shore is phenomenal. And that is in large part because we don't have the staffing to care for the lands that the public already has. And we have a responsibility as a member of our society to see that there's enough funding for these areas to be cared for. And I know, you know, and now, of course, we're complicated with the COVID virus and the slowdown in our economy. And so there doesn't appear to be an easy solution, nor has there ever been a really easy solution. I believe what it comes down to is, what is it that people value? And, of course, the first things they talk about, of course, there's shelter and food and education, and absolutely those are valuable. But this is me getting on my personal platform.
Oh, that's great. It's fine.
It's not clear to me that we need to have the military budget that we currently have at the federal level. It seems to me that our communities on every level could benefit from funds being directed to health care and housing and employment and education would be so much healthier for not just us, but everyone on the planet.
Yeah, well, that's a big topic and probably not within the remit of the program, although maybe my alternate, you know, alter ego, Jill Cody, might want to bring it up. I have, you know, I've done some reading, not for today, but in the past, about various kinds of land trusts and conservancies. That was the other thing. What's the difference between a land trust and a conservancy?
I'm not sure. Sure, exactly. And I believe each state might define them differently. Normally, a conservancy is the same as a land trust in that we're saving something. But a conservancy normally has something greater than land. They have a building. They have a specific, maybe a garden. And the conservancy may or may not own the property. For example, we hold what are called conservation easements. We do own the land, but these conservation easements are placed on the properties, at least the ones we have, by the Coastal Commission when a property is developed. There are certain restrictions placed on the use of any public lands that are set aside, sensitive habitat, and we have accepted those over the years, and we monitor them every year. We go out and look at them and take photographs. If there's a violation, we deal with that. And the nice thing about receiving these from the Coastal Commission is that it's their legal staff that's required to enforce it. Our job is only to observe and report, and that's what we do. And so that's a conservation easement, and we hold several of those as well.
The point that I wanted to bring up again is that I have read that some land trusts and holders of lands of that sort sometimes swap parcels of land with developers in order to acquire bigger plots or to transfer development rights. And I've seen that as a criticism as well, not everybody apparently is quite as committed to the preservation as you might be. Hold on a sec. Do you know anything about that?
I do. And land trusts have been criticized regarding some land trusts, never our land trust or any of the land trusts that we have in our area. This seems to be more of a Midwest Eastern issue, is that conservation easements have value. And conservations, for example, on agricultural land, it's very difficult to determine the value of that conservation easement, but it does have value. And we're always required to have appraisals, and appraisals are tricky because one appraisal will come in, let's say, at $500,000, and another will come in at $5 million. And how does the land trust and the owners of the property, how do you resolve those issues? And in a lot of situations, unfortunately, folks have gotten a lot of money for conservation easements that probably, or that some government agencies, let's put it that way, that some government agencies consider inappropriate. And that's where the primary criticism has come. And of course, we do not own our conservation easements, we value them at a dollar. And they're permanent because they came from the Coastal Commission. But in other situations where agricultural land is changing hands and transferring and has significant value, a lot of money can be involved. And there has been criticism about how those values are determined, and was it the intention initially for conservation easements to be basically a trading center for conservation easements. I think that's the criticism.
Yeah, but I mean, it's pretty clear that a piece of land that has to remain undeveloped will be appraised at less than a piece of land that can be turned into a shopping center, because under capitalism, at least, right? It's related to the value of the revenue that you can generate from the property. So, yes, I mean, yes. I can see where that, that becomes, that becomes an issue for farmers as well, right? There are certain laws, I guess, and I can't remember the name of it, right, that grant them certain advantages if they don't sell their land off to developers. But it's pretty tempting, I imagine.
Yes, and so with conservation easements, the properties that are being criticized cannot be developed into housing, but they can be productive agriculturally. And some lands can over, this is where it gets interesting with land trust, because we don't die. Land trusts go on forever. The people that administer them come and go, but the land trust itself is permanent. So when you're saying, I have 500 acres in alfalfa hay, do you appraise that on the annual crop or the lifetime of your ownership or forever? You know, this is where it gets, from my point of view, it gets difficult to determine the value. And we fortunately do not have that situation in our area, but in the larger Midwest and Eastern areas, they do have more of a challenge with that determination.
I think this is actually an issue, you know, over in the Central Valley too, that mm-hmm. because of development pressures. Again, it's, you know, it's what is the potential value of a piece of land under different uses, I guess, is
right.
how things are appraised, right? Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. And when something goes under development, meaning housing or commercial property, we call that the last crop.
On that thing about alfalfa, I actually wrote a letter to the Chronicle a couple of weeks ago, because somebody up in the Klamath Basin was complaining he couldn't ship his alfalfa to South Korea and Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I couldn't quite figure out the economics of that. But I guess it's cheap water.
I think it's cheap water. And they have this process that is fascinating. They're able to take a normal bale of alfalfa. Let's say it's, what, a couple feet high, a couple feet wide, 3 feet wide, 6 feet long, and they put it through a process that changes that into a 12 by 12 by 12 cube.
Oh, well, okay.
And they put them on these big ships, and they take them to Japan and the Middle East and you know, basically all over the world where people need hay. And then I guess I don't know, because I've never been involved with, there's a way to bring it back.
Sort of like those sponges, right? You put water, you put them in water, and they expand to 10 times their former size. Yeah. I'll have to look into that.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's take a quick break, okay, and we'll come back for the last 15 minutes of the show. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
Buddhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. Sound interesting? Faith Matters is a unique bi-monthly program that explores spirituality, life, and meaning with local religious leaders. We discuss areas of common ground and also identify distinct differences among diverse spiritual perspectives. Join us on the second and fourth Sunday evening of every month from 6 to 7 as we have thought-provoking conversations about Faith Matters on 90.7 KSQD.
You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and ksqd.org on the internet. My guest today is Joe Chamberlain, the executive director of the Coastside Land Trust in Half Moon Bay. And we've been talking about the various ins and outs of land trusts and land acquisition and ownership and various kinds of issues about the private holding of public lands, which sounds pretty oxymoronic. But in the last 15 minutes or so of the program, I actually want to shift subjects. I know that you have license plates on your car that say "Vote Joe." I think that's what they say, right? And that you ran some years ago for the California Assembly, and I wanted to pick your brains about that because, you know, God knows we're in a situation in which politics has gone crazy, and you know, we need ecological policies and practices more than ever. So I was wondering if maybe you might tell us the tale of your run for the Green Party.
Right. I ran as a Green Party member, and I ran for public office, and I also held leadership roles at the local, state, and national level. I was a co-chair of the Green Party of the United States for several years. And during the time that I was a political activist in the Green Party, I was fortunate to be able to run for the state assembly here in California. And that was, I really enjoyed it, but it is not something one can go into unprepared. And for a Green Party member, I did extremely well. I got 20% of the vote. So that was really good.
And well, tell us some more about it. You know, what I'm, you know, I'm obviously we're facing a kind of a conundrum, which is that if in November we have too many third parties on the ballot, that could have a real impact on the outcome, especially of the presidential election. On the other hand, you know, the major parties are all looking for business as usual. So, you know, what did you campaign on? You know, would you recommend it to youngsters that might be seeking public office?
I would recommend, and remember, we're talking about a career as a public servant. If you're interested in, and of course, being a nonprofit is very similar, that you're a public servant, which means I have a platform of my own, but the skill that is really needed is listening to your community, both the people and the environment in your community, and hearing what their needs are and finding out how you can help them. Now, in my particular case, I ran some years ago, and at that time, there was no gay marriage. There were no recognition of LGBT rights. There were, I'm trying to think of some of the other things that we ran on. There was very much voter suppression. There was not ranked voting. There was, there were just significant things that when you run as I did as a Green Party member, I was able to push that agenda. And I can say that I am incredibly impressed with the California State Legislature at this point, that they have over these years since I ran taken many of my issues and the Green Party's issues and made them law. And, you know, for example, Obama tried to get health care for all. He came very close. And I think with proper leadership, the Affordable Care Act, which is what people refer to as Obamacare, is a wonderful program. And people who are in that program are very happy with that. And I believe that with proper leadership at the national level, that could be expanded and or a way of expanding Medicare. Medicare is an interesting program because it we took the most expensive people and insured them, people over 65. And, you know, you couldn't create a more doomed program than saying, okay, well, I'm going to go into sales and I'm only going to have clients who can't pay. That's basically what Medicare is, and that's the shame of it. And the Affordable Care Act, under the leadership of Barack Obama and Joe Biden, attempted to solve that problem, and I believe it's well on its way with proper leadership. And I supported health care for all when I ran, and so of course I worked with all of the organization, the activists and the nonprofits who were working in that area, to support them and understand the language and legislation that they saw would help their particular program. So that was, I enjoyed that very much. And of course, the same was true of, with education. And you can kind of go through the big topics, housing. And, for example, I don't know if this will ever come to be, but I have always, and I ran on this platform, is that I believe that public housing should be eventually owned by the people who pay rent on it, so that they can get into the housing market. If we're going to have private housing, then everyone who pays rent in any way should have, through public housing, should have the benefit of owning that particular condominium or townhouse, so that they can care for it, and as the value goes up, they can move into a larger residence and have full ownership of a home. And that's one way people can get into home ownership in today's crazy real estate market. And we have to fund that. We have to help people do that. Because the day, you know, the 40s and 50s, you know, we had the GI Bill, and we had the federal housing, and of course, neither of those were eligible. African Americans were not eligible for those programs. And people don't know that. I don't understand the crime that has been committed against people who are American citizens and have basically should have the same rights as all of us. They have been denied that. And so those were I kind of get on my soapbox here, Ronnie. So, but those were the types of things that that I'm very passionate about still, and that those were the types of things that I ran on. And over the years since I ran, many of my concerns have been brought forward because I was able to help people create momentum for change and help recruit people with the green values, our Joe values, whichever you want to call them,
okay.
and move forward. And so I think that if you want to run for office, there's several things. You know, you need to know your subject. You know, you've got to educate yourself. You've got to be able to really listen, and you have to have a passion for helping the people and their environment.
Do you think there is still a role for third parties? Let's stick to California because, you know, especially the legislature is in the hands of the Democrats right now. And, you know, the Republicans look to be in a fairly weak position for the indefinite future. So do you think there's room for a third party like the Green Party in California?
I do think there is. And, one of the things to study, if you want to go into politics, is to study different democracies around the world. We are one of the few democracies that is what they call first past the post. Many democracies have a more, democratic system. For
it's
example,
proportional representation.
I mean, ranked voting is just a beginning of that. You know, your first choice, second choice, third choice. And San Francisco does that, and many communities in the United States are starting to adopt that. And that's the first step toward a more democratic and a more representative government, because first past the post means you just have to get one more vote than the other person to win. And that doesn't mean that that person with the extra votes has is speaking for the community in a broad sense. They're only speaking for the people who voted for them. So if they got 52% and somebody else got 48%, half the people who voted didn't want that philosophy, but they're stuck with it. Whereas if you have a multi-party system and you rank folks, so you'd say, in this election, let's say Bernie was running as an independent, Joe Biden as a Democrat, and Donald Trump as a Republican, and let's just make up a libertarian down here. So libertarians and Republicans
are more closely aligned in their beliefs, and Greens and Democrats are more closely aligned, and Bernie is very closely aligned with Greens. So if you were to vote, let's say if I were to vote and those were my people, I would vote for Bernie and then for Joe, and I wouldn't have to worry about electing one of the less kind people, shall we say.
Attractive. Yeah.
So, and as you know, I know Nader is blamed for Florida, but, you know, Al Gore won Florida. The Supreme Court chose the president. We didn't elect the president. We did not elect Bush. He was chosen by the Supreme Court. And I don't remember that ever happening in the history of this country. And I find that very disturbing.
Well, no, it hadn't, not in that particular form, but now that it has happened, we know it can happen. Anyway, listen, Joe, we're just about out of time. Are there any last things that you might want to tell our audience?
I suppose so. What I would say is, get out and enjoy our beautiful outdoors, especially now when we're not able to be as social as we were for a while. The open spaces are here for you to enjoy. They're open, and it's really, we consider ourselves kind of the mental health nonprofits for folks that need to just get out and exercise and breathe the fresh air, be with your partner, your family, and have a nice time outside. And it really is restorative, and I urge folks to do that.
Okay, well, listen, thank you so much, Joe, for being on Sustainability Now. You can find information about the Coastside Land Trust at www.coastsidelandtrust.org. So 2 weeks from today, on June 28th, my guest will be Kalina Brown, a 2019-20 Ray Diversity Fellow at the Ocean Conservancy. And she's been working in particular on climate change in the Caribbean region. And she's entering the Coastal Sustainability Program at UC Santa Cruz this coming fall, where she'll be a Prince Albert of Monaco II Foundation Climate Change Master Scholar. So we'll also be talking about coastal sustainability issues. So join me on Sunday, June 28th, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQID. And as always, this show is going to be rebroadcast this coming Tuesday morning at 6 a.m. for those of you who can't resist getting up early. And you can find program broadcasts at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB. I want to thank Emily Dunham, our engineer in the studio, for her sterling help. And until every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Well, I don't exactly know what's going on in the world today. I don't know what there is to say about it.